Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, if you enjoyed the debt ceiling debate, here's something to be thankful for. The next budget crisis is now officially scheduled for the day before Thanksgiving. Under the new agreement, that's when Congress must approve the next $1 trillion in deficit reduction or watch automatic cuts to Medicare and the military take effect, which neither party wants. So as you preheat the turkey oven, you can look forward to more Senate speeches like these.
This bill, this so-called solution, doesn't fundamentally change our spending and debt picture. It just plays around the margins. It doesn't make any big change whatsoever.
Cutting the safety net for a lot of the most vulnerable people in our society, we can do that, but we can't. We just simply can't ask one more dollar of shared sacrifice from the millionaires and billionaires who have made so much money in the last decade and who have received, thanks to this Congress, huge tax breaks. It is not fair.
No one got what they wanted. Everyone had to give something up. People on the right are upset. People on the left are upset. People in the middle are upset. It was a compromise.
We've changed the agenda from spend, spend, spend to cut, cut, cut. If we did the same thing with every debt ceiling increase for the next 10 years that we've done here, we'd balance the budget in 10 years.
Senators David Vitter, Tom Harkin, Harry Reid, and Lamar Alexander, in that order, to Democrats to Republicans, with their various spins on the debt ceiling deal that the Senate will likely approve at noon today. Let's debrief and look ahead and also get two views of the local impact of the deal, with one New York City congressman who voted yes and one who voted no. The yes vote came from Republican Michael Grimm of Brooklyn and Staten Island. We'll talk to him second. First, Democrat Gerald Nadler of Brooklyn and Manhattan, who voted no. Hi, Congressman Nadler. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning.
The House Democrats wound up split down the middle on this vote, 95-95 in the Democratic caucus. Why did you vote no, and why do you think the party was so divided among yourselves?
Well, I'd say that most of the people who voted yes in the Democrats hated it anyway, but voted for it because they thought it would be catastrophic to have a default, which it would be. I voted no because I think this is, A, a terrible deal. It'll really hurt the middle class. B, it'll make it harder to get out of the recession we're in, and in fact, I think it almost guarantees that the unemployment rate is going to continue above 9% for a good many years to come. Three, it sets a terrible, terrible precent. And guarantees, you just heard Senator Lamar Alexander say that every time you have a debt ceiling increase, you're going to have to cut, and it'll be cutting over the same time period. So you'll have what the Republicans just did was something unprecedented in American history. It's one thing to come into Congress, and you control one of the two bodies, the House, but not the Senate, not the presidency, and fight as hard as you can for what you want. But you have to compromise because the people on the other side control the Senate and the presidency. You're not going to get everything you want. They're not going to get everything they want. The Republicans came out and said, look, we're going to hijack the country. We're going to say that if you don't give us what we want, we are going to destroy the economy by failing to raise the debt ceiling. And remember, raising the debt ceiling is simply agreeing to pay the bills that were incurred as a result of decisions made 3, 5, and 7 years ago, mostly, by the way, during the Bush administration. It's not an agreement about what you're going to do in the future. It's just an agreement that you're going to borrow the money that you need to borrow to pay the bills you already incurred. You must do that. And it's never been really controversial in American history before. Now, the whole debate that we just had about what should be our levels of taxation in the future, what should be our levels of spending in the future, should be over the budget.
Right. But the Republicans forced this crisis by tying debt reduction to the debt ceiling. That's another way of saying what
that was. That was in effect extortion against the entire country.
Do the Republicans
either you give us what we want or we'll destroy the economy.
But do the Republicans not have some point that, considering the size of the national debt at this point, new borrowing should be offset by debt reduction, and this was a way to get people's attention?
No, I don't think they have any point at all, first of all. But first of all, it's debatable what the size of borrowing should be over the long term. The size of borrowing now is not debatable because it is determined by decisions made 3 and 5 years ago. You have to borrow a certain amount of money to pay the bills that were already incurred. As I said, the level of future borrowing, not right now, but in the future years, the level of expenditures and taxes, that should be debated in the budget, which is coming up.
Now, most of the cuts don't take effect until 2013, I read, mm-hmm. but you're quoted in the Daily News today saying the deal threatens payments to 9/11 responders under the Zadroga bill.
Yes.
Did you say that? How come?
Well, because it is the first stage of reductions, the first $900 and some odd billion, is from discretionary spending. This is discretionary spending, and they're going to have to find that money, and this is not protected by law.
Discretionary spending means not Medicaid, not Medicare, and not the military?
No, the military is discretionary spending, too.
It is for these purposes.
It means not the, Medicare, Medicaid, veterans benefits, interest on the debt, a few other things. Secondly, that commission that's going to be set up to find another $1.5 trillion starting next year, they can take it out of the Zadroga bill, too. It's not protected under that. There are certain things that are protected, like Medicare for benefits for recipients, Social Security, that are protected by law against what the commission will do. But the Zadroga bill is not. And secondly, if they don't come up with an agreement, or if Congress doesn't enact their agreement, automatic cuts across the board take place, which would include the Zadroga bill.
The Daily News today also quotes liberal economist James Parrott saying the debt ceiling deal will lead to more unemployment in New York City. Do you take that position?
Yes, I do. We are in a first of all, we are in a terrible economic crisis, and the main economic crisis is employment. The debt crisis is not a debt crisis. We had our national debt is arguably too high. We have to deal with it in the out years, but we can leave that for a year or two. Right now, we got it, and if we got unemployment down to 5%, which is what it was 3 years ago, that would take care of half the deficit by itself. Instead, what this says is government can't do any of the things that are necessary to increase employment and to get the economy moving again. And if government won't do it the way this economy is going, we're going to have 9.5% unemployment for the foreseeable future. Secondly, the Medicare cuts that will come in the second part of this thing will certainly include things that New York specializes in, like graduate medical education, and it'll really hit our hospitals or one of our largest employers very hard.
Just on the cuts and the potential impact on employment, this obviously precludes much stimulus in federal
yes.
spending right now. But the cuts themselves, the Republicans keep pointing out, don't really take effect in this fiscal year, not really until 2013. So it's not like the government is withdrawing more money from the economy
Some of the cuts do take effect this year, but not too many of them. But anyone who thinks that in 2013 we're going to have a reasonable unemployment rate and we're not going to be and cutting government spending is going to be okay for the economy is smoking something. There is no reason to believe that the economy is going to be any better in 2013 than now, despite what the administration or anybody else may say.
Congressman Gerald Nadler with us, Democrat from Brooklyn and Manhattan. We'll talk to Republican Congressman Michael Grimm from Brooklyn and Staten Island next. He voted yes. Nadler voted no on the debt ceiling deal. Do you happen to know if Pell Grants or subsidized student loans survived this vote intact? I know they were being debated last
week. Pell Grants survived intact. That was one of the negotiating successes at the end for the Democrats, one of the few. But graduate student loans, Stafford loans, it did not. So graduate students are now going to have to pay interest even while in school before they're earning any money.
Later today, and listeners take note, we're hosting an online chat at noon on our politics website, It's a Free Country, about the debt ceiling deal. And one of the questions that we're... Go ahead.
I want to make one thing very clear. People have to understand about this whole so-called debt crisis. The reason we have this huge deficit now is not because spending has run amok. Spending on discretionary spending is about the same now as it was in adjusted for population and for inflation as it was in 2001 when we were running a very large surplus. What has changed, our number one, accounting for about half the deficit, is the Bush tax cuts. Number two, two unfunded wars. And number three, the recession. Those are what have caused the deficit. And to really deal with the deficit, first, you fix the recession. And then You have to increase taxes on the wealthy people who've gotten all this extra money and have paying less taxes than in most of America, in most of
right.
our history.
Well, on the Bush stuff having caused this deficit, I heard a stat yesterday from a Republican, tell me if you dispute this, that in 2006, the deficit for that year was only $100 billion something. Now it's over $1 trillion. So that if all those, you know, if the Bush wars and the Bush tax cuts created huge new debt. It didn't come out in big annual deficits by 2006.
I don't know offhand what the 2006 figure was. I do know the following. In January of 2009, just before President Obama was inaugurated, the Congressional Budget Office, which is nonpartisan, forecast the deficit for 2010 as $1.5 trillion. Before the president was inaugurated, before they did anything. And in fact, the reason the Bush tax cuts were scheduled to expire in 2010 was because the forecast back in 2001, when they passed them, said that in the out year, starting in 2010, they would cause very large deficits.
I started to mention that at noon, we're hosting an online chat on our politics website. It's freecountry.org about the debt ceiling debate. And one of the questions that we'll be asking people who participate is, how did the president do? Try as he might, he couldn't get tax increases on the wealthy or tax loophole closings into this deal, so it wouldn't
and
all be cut.
That makes this very, very unfair.
Obviously. Does this just mean the president blinked and should be seen that way by his supporters?
Well, to some extent. I mean, if I had to criticize the president, I would say he underestimated the ruthlessness of the Republicans. He thought they were reasonable, and when they clearly aren't, he didn't think they would be willing to blackmail the entire country by saying we'll destroy the economy if you don't do what we want, which they were. He should have went last December when they made the deal that extended the Bush tax cuts and did a few other things. He should have dealt with raising the deficit, the debt ceiling then. He said at the time he didn't do that because he was sure the Republicans would be reasonable. That's mistake number one. Number two, I would say he has, many legal authorities say, authority under the 14th Amendment to which says you cannot question the public debt of the United States. It shall not be called into question. Insofar as enforcing the debt ceiling would force you not to be able to pay part of the public debt, that would be unconstitutional. So he has, according to many legal authorities, the authority without Congress to abrogate the national debt insofar as necessary to pay existing debt and bills.
And he wasn't
his refusal
sure
to do that,
yes.
Or even to threaten to do that, I think deprived him of a lot of leverage in the negotiations.
Last thing before we talk to Congressman Grimm, and another thing that we'll be asking during our noon chat at itsfreecountry.org, is it in a way a good thing that with divided government that the American people voted in, this was a bipartisan compromise? Let me play again a clip that we heard earlier from Congressman Paul Ryan, of course, the Republican chairman of the Budget Committee. Listen to Paul Ryan.
What this has done, it has brought our two parties together. And so I'd just like to take a second to reflect for a moment the fact that we have a bipartisan compromise here.
And it was the Democrats and Republicans roughly in the large center, if I can loosely use that term, who voted this in together with 66 Republicans voting no and 95 Democrats voting no, half the caucus, including yourself. Is this in a way compromise politics, coalition politics in action in a good sense?
Absolutely not. This is the worst thing I've ever seen. The 95 Democrats who voted for it, barring a few who may have thought it was a reasonable compromise, did it because they were bowing to extortion. They voted for it not because they thought it was a reasonable compromise, not because they thought that the Republicans had bargained reasonably, but because if you didn't vote for it, then the country was going to default and it was going to lead to an economic catastrophe. What the Republicans did here was not negotiate in good faith. They literally said to us, to everybody, like a bunch of gangsters, that's a nice economy you got here. Pity if something were to happen to it. They threatened to destroy the economy, and that was the threat. This was not normal negotiations.
Right.
This was hostage taking and negotiating with and giving in to the hostage takers lest they murder the hostages.
Using the hostage being
the economy.
The hostage and murder analogy, despite the reappearance of Gabrielle Giffords last night.
Well, Gabriel's coming back was wonderful, but it's got nothing to do with what the Republicans did. And I'll tell you something else. That kind of politics will destroy Democratic government in this country over a long period if it keeps going on.
Thanks, Congressman Gerald Nadler, Democrat from Brooklyn and Manhattan, who voted no on the debt ceiling agreement.
Thank you.
Now, freshman Republican Congressman Michael Grimm from Brooklyn and Staten Island, who voted yes. Hello, Congressman Grimm. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning. Nice to be back.
On Congressman Nadler's last point, were you listening there at the end?
Yes, I understand. I'm now a gangster.
A gangster and a terrorist and a potential murderer. But let me ask the question this way. Do you think it's fair to say, from a negotiating and politics standpoint, that the Republicans ultimately would have been willing to miss the deadline and risk whatever consequences? So they, therefore, you were able to hold firm on no new taxes, and the Democrats were just less willing to risk a default?
Well, I guess you could say that. I think that is accurate, but why? The question is why? Is it because we don't care about the economy? We don't care about the country? Absolutely not. That's absurd. The point is, we recognize that there were two issues. One was a simple issue, the debt ceiling. That's simple. What is the other issue? The other issue is the underlying problem. The underlying problem is we have too much debt, and if we do not put a plan in place to start to pay down that debt, then guess what? Regardless of what the president wants or the Congress wants, the rest of the world, like the rating agencies, whether it be S&P or Moody's or whoever is lending us money, is going to deem the United States non-creditworthy. They're going to stop lending us money, and that's not something we can fix. So that's the issue that Republicans are saying. We can't just raise the debt ceiling irresponsibly and not put a plan in place to tell the rest of the world that, yes, we recognize we have a problem, and, yes, we're going to deal with it in a way that is responsible and will eventually bring economic security for this great nation. So it wasn't a matter of holding out just because we don't like the president or we want to act like terrorists, as they would say. It's because we're trying to be responsible. And for the first time, we're not allowing politics as usual or Washington as usual. We're saying enough of that. We've raised the debt ceiling 77 times or something like that in the history of this country. And no one has ever said, hey, maybe we should put some spending caps in place, or maybe we should put some protocols or procedures to prevent us from having to need to raise it many more times in the future.
But President Obama says this was an unbalanced approach, and you could have satisfied the ratings agency and secured a long-term deficit reduction and debt reduction with shared sacrifice, one quarter of it coming from millionaires and billionaires to get real debt reduction without, with a little tax increasing.
And could I just stop you right there? You said one quarter of it coming from millionaires and billionaires. That's a great soundbite. I mean, it sounds fantastic. There's just one problem with that. It's not based in reality. The president, Jerry Nadler, they're not honest people when they say that. When they say that, they are not telling the truth to the American people. Here's a fact. If you took every millionaire and billionaire in America and taxed them at 100% of everything they earn, 100%, you would not even scratch the surface in our debt problem. It would be 9 days and 23 hours worth of deficit reduction. It's nothing. It's not enough. So when they say that, it's not an honest debate. Even if you raise taxes on the millionaires and billionaires, it would not help the debt problem. What's driving our debt are the entitlements and the fact that we spend too much money. They want to say it's a revenue problem, but every economist that's looked at it understands it's a spending problem.
Well, Obama wants to say it's both and cut spending three-quarters of the total and raise revenues one-quarter of the total.
But he says that, that's what he says to you and to the media. But when you get behind closed doors, that's not what he says. And I'll tell you what he said. He told the media he wanted $4 trillion in cuts. Then he went behind closed doors with Speaker John Boehner and he said, well, it's actually $2.2 trillion in cuts, which were not real cuts. They were budgetary gimmicks, and $1.8 trillion in tax hikes. Tax hikes on the job creators, not millionaires, not billionaires, but those making $200,000 and $250,000 and above. Those are the job creators. And by the way, the $2.2 trillion in cuts, most of that, the majority of that, was money that we already know we're not going to spend in Afghanistan and Iraq. So we already know we have a drawdown coming. So he's going to say, since we're not going to spend that money in the future, that will count as our cuts. That's not a cut. It's a gimmick. And raising taxes on people, 200,000, 250,000, are the very people that create the jobs. So, again, that's counterproductive mm-hmm. to growing the economy. If you yeah. want to increase revenue, you grow the economy. That's the best way to increase revenue. And tax reform. Everyone in this country knows we need tax reform. We put that on the table with the Paul Ryan budget. But that was demonized, demagogued, you know, all of that stuff.
Now, you voted yes. You were elected with Tea Party support. Sarah Palin and others endorsed you in your primary race, especially against a more establishment Republican. But 66 Republicans voted no on this. We played a soundbite of one a little while before you came on saying this is just, you know, not enough spending cuts to really be worth my vote. Why weren't you in what some analysts are calling the Tea Party bloc voting no?
It's actually very simple, because I came here to govern. I came here to make the tough decisions and to look at things through various lenses. One of those lenses is to say, am I here to make a point or am I here to make progress? And I've decided to make progress. Do I think this is enough? No, I don't. Do I think that this is even nearly close to being enough? No. But what this does is it sets the stage for continued cuts. This is the first time in our history that we are going to cut more than we're raising the debt ceiling. It's the first time in our history that for two consecutive years we are reducing spending. I recognize something, maybe because I've been in government for 16 years, I see just how systemically broken Washington is. It is so broken that it is not going to be fixed in 6 or 7 months. And my colleagues that think it can be fixed overnight, I disagree with them on that. I think that we have to accept that this government is so broken that it's going to take several steps and several stages to fix it, but we have already taken a big step in changing the mindset, changing the discussion, and changing the orientation towards policy. And from that, I believe, then you will start to see much, much larger cuts. And a big part of that is winning the presidency in 2012, because as long as we have this president who's so addicted to spending and has been on a spending spree for 2.5 years, we're not going to be able to impose our will on cutting spending. It's just not going to happen. So I think it's about being based in reality and changing as much as we can now so that we have the stage set that when we have a Republican president, we can really do the big systemic mandatory changes to spending that need to be done to get this country back on track.
We have a couple minutes left with Republican Congressman Michael Grimm from parts of Brooklyn and all of Staten Island. Congressman Nadler was talking about possible local impacts of the spending cuts in this agreement, including, as he sees it, on unemployment in New York City because of federally funded programs becoming less, on local research hospitals, which rely on federal aid, and even on payments to 9/11 responders under the Zadroga Act being diminished. Do you accept any of those as true?
Without looking at the specifics, again, the committees have to decide exactly where the cuts are going to be, but I will tell you this. There's no question there's going to be difficult times across the board for everyone, not just New York City, but across this entire country. But I would say to Jerry Nadler, why do the people in Staten Island and Brooklyn that have to go home and try to put food on the table for their children, have to go to their business and try to run their business, why do they have to sacrifice every single day, live within their budgetary means, have to have control over their spending? Why do they have to do it every day, but the federal government doesn't? The people, you know, I think their voices have been heard. They're frustrated, and they should be. They wanted common sense and a realistic approach to bring real solutions, and that means spending discipline. And if we want people to have the economic freedom in the future that they've had in this country, you know, for so many decades, then we have to make the tough decisions. And you know, if you ask Jerry Nadler, if you think we should spend more money, he would say yes.
Well, you say economic freedom. He said that economists see the Bush tax cuts as having contributed a lot to this economic straitjacket. The tax cuts have not spurred enough economic growth to become revenue neutral or revenue positive, even though that's the trickle-down theory we always hear. So if that's a fact, then did tax cuts in the name of economic freedom help put us in an economic straitjacket?
No, what I think is happening again is we have been hearing blame Bush for years and years and years now from people like Jerry Nadler and the Democratic Party. The reality is very simple. This president has been in office for 2.5 years. He promised the American people that we would not see unemployment go above 8% if we passed his failed stimulus package. This president has spent more money than any other president in history, $3.7 trillion in 2.5 years.
But on the debt, Nadler was saying, you know, we have to look at the accumulated Bush debt, two wars that were fought off the books with borrowed money, plus all the money given away in terms of federal revenue from the tax cuts.
It still doesn't equal $3.7 trillion that this president has spent in 2.5 years. President Bush was there how many years? I mean, let's just do the math. This is an absurd argument. You cannot come in and spend the amount of money that this president has spent. And by the way, what did we get for it? Did we spend that money on infrastructure, rebuild our bridges, our roads, our tunnels? No. We squandered that money. And this president wants to continue to squander it. None of the monies that have been spent over the last 2.5 years went to those that create the jobs or for infrastructure to rebuild our country. None of it. So it's almost an absurd argument to keep saying, well, Bush tax cuts and so on. It's very simple. We want to have a fairer tax in this country. We desperately need it. And that's bipartisan. That's not a Republican issue or a Democratic issue. That's an American issue. Our tax system is way too complicated, and it simply doesn't make sense. We should have a fairer tax system. We should definitely close the loopholes. I agree with the Democrats on that. Let's close some of the loopholes. Let's make it fair. Let's let everyone pay their fair share. Do you realize that almost 50% of Americans don't pay any taxes at all?
Give me one loophole you'd like to close, since you're going to have that debate.
I think a lot of the corporate loopholes, a lot of the corporations that aren't paying taxes right now, or those that are, their tax rate is 35%, but their effective tax rate is 14%. That's because of a lot of loopholes that they're taking advantage of that need to stop. And, you know, one of the things I would make sure in the new tax code is if you're outsourcing jobs, then there's a penalty for that. We shouldn't be rewarding those that are sending jobs overseas. You know, so there's a lot of things we can do, but most of it is about simplifying our tax code, broadening our base, lowering the rates for everyone. Let's make them fairer, and that should increase revenue more than if we raise taxes, certainly more if we raise taxes on millionaires and billionaires, which is just a completely disingenuous argument.
Republican Congressman Michael Grimm, freshman from Staten Island and parts of Brooklyn, you and 534 of your closest colleagues will be having that debate between now and the day before Thanksgiving, when we may do this deadline dance all over again before the next trillion plus of deficit reduction has to kick in. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you.
And listeners, we just got word that the president will be speaking to the press at 12:15 this afternoon. As it happens, we will be hosting our Tuesday live chat on our politics website, itsafreecountry.org, at the same time. That's every Tuesday at noon. And so we will have a live video feed of the president at that time on It's a Free Country. And we'll be asking you in our noon politics chat about the debt deal, if you got the first question to the president, what would it be? So mark it down, noon today, live coverage of the president and our weekly politics chat at itsafreecountry.org. Brian Lehren, WNYC. And coming up next, kind of an addendum to the budget negotiation dance, why 40,000 people unfollowed President Obama on Twitter last Friday, but about as many signed up with him on Saturday. Stay tuned.